Hello, my name is Robert Scaper, author of the book Making Your Miles Count, Taxes, Taxes, Taxes. I have an MBA degree and operate an accounting firm exclusively serving Canadian lease owner operators. This CD seminar is about lease owner operators' tax options. It is brought to you by THR Consulting Group. THR stands for Trucking Human Resources, but we answer the phone THR. The seminar is divided into two parts, the lecture and the question and answer period. Hopefully it can help you in your business. What you're about to hear is a seminar with a lot of information. Some drivers who have a lot of interest in the subject, I hope, will find it very interesting and easy to listen to. Some, however, may struggle with the mountain of content. For those, I recommend taking it easy. Listen only to sections at a time before moving on. Grab a few cups of caffeinated coffee, none of the emasculated stuff. Open your window and get some fresh air every now and then. Occasionally put your index finger in your ear and check if you're bleeding. Some people find their brain swell. But seriously, take it easy. Talk to others who have listened to it and discuss it among yourselves. It's a significant change to your financial model. So let's start where you are today. Most lease owner operators in Canada are self-employed. Starting a business is almost as easy as just standing up and saying so. In most jurisdictions, a business name registration is not necessary. However, a separate business account at your bank is recommended. Sometimes a bank will require a business name registration, but not always. Otherwise, your business starts under your personal name. Income tax filed annually with December 31st as a year-end is the norm. Bringing your paperwork and receipts to an accountant once a year, all expenses are deducted from your income and taxes calculated on the balance. You have 4 months to pay, 5.5 months to file your return, with a deadline being June 15th. Under this system, Canada Revenue Agency may require quarterly income tax installments. Your GST number is assigned to you by Canada Revenue Agency directly. It's originated under your personal social insurance number. If partnership, then both social insurance numbers are used. GST returns are usually filed quarterly, sometimes annually, or even monthly if requested. There are three areas operators can legally reduce their income tax. The first is the business use of personal vehicle. In operating a business, there are times when it is a necessity to use your personal vehicle for business use. It is totally legitimate to expense those times provided that records are kept. A note of caution, the Income Tax Act is very clear on one thing. Driving to and from work is not tax deductible. Any reference to going to work or returning from work will always be considered personal and therefore not deductible. Allow me to go through what is legally required, and then I'll comment on what's practically done. There is a logbook requirement for your personal vehicle. Recording both personal and business miles over the entire year. You must keep receipts of your fuel for the entire year. All your maintenance receipts, insurance, depreciation, lease expense. Records must be kept for each vehicle used. Fuel, log, maintenance, insurance, depreciation, etc. must be separate for each vehicle. That's a lot of paperwork.
There is a reason why a personal vehicle log is needed. Accountants and Canada Revenue Agency need to know what percentage of the vehicle expenses were personal and what percentage was for business use. The kilometer business percentage is applied to the total receipts that was kept.
But that's not what a lot of bookkeepers or accountants ask or require. In fact, very few accountants ask for logbooks for personal vehicles. Here are some reasons. The first is competition. If one firm follows the rules, too many operators or potential clients, who hate yet another logbook, walk away to another accountant, who will estimate the expense. Most accountants or bookkeepers know the approximate dollar figure or percentage that might flag an audit and therefore estimate the expense based on that. In essence, they guess 10% of your car, 25%, 50%. Since most operators do not get audited, the risk for reassessment is low. Some clients actually believe that logbooks are not necessary because they have been audited and the auditor has not required them. This is a dangerous half-truth. It is more dependent on the attitude of the auditor than the letter of the law. What happens when the auditor isn't convinced? Who carries the liability if something isn't accepted? If the accountant is designated, the accountant may be liable. However, if a designated accountant, CA, CGA, CMA, requires you to sign a waiver, then you pay. If the accountant or bookkeeper is not designated, then usually you pay. Conclusion: each vehicle needs its own logs and all receipts. The second way to reduce your taxes is the business use of home expense. Home expenses are very similar to personal vehicle, except you don't need a log, of course. As substitution for a log, usually a square foot assessment is made. There is another method, ratio of rooms, but it's very seldom used. Percentage of square footage usage applies to your hydro, gas, heating, insurance, tax, maintenance, repairs, and they all need receipts. That is a very simple way of calculating your expenses of your business to your home. The third area operators can legally reduce their income tax is travel expenses on the road, meals and hygiene, showers, etc. Let's first discuss that in a historical sense. Operators are a relatively new phenomena in the income tax field. They were only introduced in the late 70s and 80s. Prior to that, there was only company drivers or trucking companies. Currently, approximately 8 to 12% of all Canadian drivers are operators. An estimated 75 to 90% of all operators are self-employed or sole proprietors. Regarding meals, since introduction of lease owner operators, Canada Revenue Agency has treated operators very much the same as they do company drivers. Currently, it is the most controversial topic in the industry. The TL2 simplified method is the most common method of calculating meal expenses for long-distance drivers. It is the form that drivers get at the end of the year along with their T4. There are two parts to it: the amount of days the employee was away, and the rate of credit allowed the employee by Canada Revenue Agency guidelines. If you are an operator and hand in your log sheets or a summary to your tax preparer every year, you are using the simplified method. The advantages of the TL2 simplified method is quite simple. Number one, no meal receipts are needed. It produces an annual tax return for all company drivers or produced a tax reduction for self-employed operators. It is very simple and a very popular system. The disadvantages of using the TL2 simplified method: the qualifying days have restrictions. You have to travel further than 160 kilometers from your municipality. You have to be away from your municipality for more than 24 hours. The TL2 simplified method virtually eliminates all daytime or shorter haul operators. Also, the rate of pay. It is controlled and published by legislation and Canada Revenue Agency guideline rates. Used to be $33 a day, then $45 a day, and currently $51 a day. The $51 per day is not $51 after tax money. It's the starting figure for calculating your non-refundable tax credit. It is subject to formula restrictions and conversions. For more detailed description of published rates and their after-tax calculations back to 1992, see Canada Truck Operators blog site off thrconsulting.ca. Also, the restrictions and rates are subject to change. For example, in 1994, Paul Martin in his federal budget stated, "Some industries are not paying their fair share of taxes," and then promptly decreased deductibility from 80% down to 50%. And in March 19, 2007, Stephen Harper with the Lunch Bag Letdown campaign reversed the 50% back to 80% over 5 years. We'll get back to that shortly. Let's return to a prior point. What is the actual after-tax value of the $51? The public may think it's actually $51, but it's not. It's the starting figure for calculating your non-refundable tax credit or after-tax credit. 2006 produced an $8.31 after-tax benefit. Prior to October 2006, operators, by practice, were allowed to use their logbooks and the TL2 simplified method to calculate their meal expenses on the road. However, in October 2006, an Income Tax Information Circular, IC-73-21R9, was distributed. It emphasized the importance of both the employer and employee signing the forms. Self-employed sole proprietor operators, who represent about 75 to 90% of all operators, are not, nor ever will be, employees. If self-employed operators want to truly comply to the Income Tax Act, they must keep all their meal receipts. In the spring of 2007, just as my book Making Your Miles Count, Taxes, Taxes, Taxes came into publication, 25 operators from Moncton, New Brunswick were audited and everyone's returns were reassessed due to the use of the TL2 simplified method. CRA got back a reported about $5,000 from each operator, or $2,500 per year. The result? Panic. Either because of the circular or the well-publicized audit results, accounting firms all across Canada suddenly required self-employed operators to gather meal receipts. However, not all firms are demanding receipts. If they are not, they are either requiring waivers or are not liable anyway because of their non-designated status. Either way, operators are now at risk. It's the same situation as the business use of personal vehicle without a log. Note, 90 to 95% of citizens aren't audited, so you may be okay. Non-compliant, but probably okay. However, audits on operators have doubled in the last few years. Conclusion: massive disinformation. No matter who you talk to, you'll probably get several impassioned viewpoints. But the truth is, legally, you need receipts. And now the bad news. The receipts that you save have the exact same formula and conversions applied to them as the $51 does. Therefore, there was an actual decrease from $8.31 in 2006 down to $8 approximately in 2011. This is not the fault of the lunch bag letdown. It's Canada Revenue Agency's way of giving up one thing while taking back another. End result? Worse than before. So what's your alternative? Maybe you should lobby the government to allow operators to use the TL2 again. And then lobby the government to raise the TL2 value above $51. And then lobby the government to allow TL2 operators who are not further than 160 kilometers or return to the terminal before 24 hours lapses. With all your lobbying, how can you be sure that any change in government will not reverse your lobbying? Do you really want to drive to Ottawa every year with your hat in hand asking for their bounty and blessing? Do you really want to be subjected to a political roller coaster? I'm sure Ottawa and lobbyists would like you to be. However, there is a much better alternative to annual lobbying and government dependence. Let's talk about an entirely different system called Estimated Reimbursement for Job-Related Costs. I'll tell you a story. An auditor leaves an office and gets into their personal vehicle. On a form, recorded the date, the description, and the beginning odometer. The auditor drives to the audit, performs the work, and drives back, recording the ending odometer. No depreciation, insurance, maintenance, gas receipts needed, just a completed form. The auditor is reimbursed their costs using cents per kilometer. The auditor receives a separate check from their regular paycheck. The reimbursement is classified by CRA as a non-taxable benefit. The question is, how much are they paid per kilometer? The Treasury Board of Canada or National Joint Council provides maximum cents per kilometer allowed by CRA. Employers can pay lower rates if the employee agrees, just not more. Let's take a look at October 1st, 2010 rates. Alberta is 51.5 cents per kilometer, British Columbia 52 cents, Manitoba 47.5 cents, New Brunswick 49.5, Newfoundland and Labrador 53 cents, Northwest Territories 58 cents, Nova Scotia 51 cents, Nunavut 58 cents, Ontario 55 cents per kilometer, Prince Edward Island 50 cents, Quebec 56.5, Saskatchewan 46, and the Yukon 60.5 cents per kilometer. What allows the auditor to collect these rates is their employer-employee agreement. We'll get back to that later. When classified as in travel status, auditors can be reimbursed for all travel-related costs, not just personal vehicle. This also includes the reimbursement of meals. The auditor is not restricted by 160 kilometers or municipality travel or the 24-hour rule. They are reimbursed using the specifics of his or her employer-employee agreement. For example, if the auditor leaves before 8 a.m., they qualify for breakfast. If not, they only start qualifying at lunch. It can be that specific. Here's a couple other examples of employer-employee agreements. I had a prior client visit me a while back who is now a co-pilot for a major airliner. His employer-employee agreement is worded like this. For every hour he is away from his home terminal, he receives $4, therefore $96 per day. Pipeline welders have been receiving living meal allowance, living allowance for decades, and it ranges from $95 a day to $135 per day, depending on contract and circumstances. Trucking companies used to regularly pay meal allowances, some still do, albeit smaller figures. For those who have been in the industry for decades, you can remember the time when companies stopped paying meal allowances. When they hired someone new, they declared, "This rate per mile includes meals." Travel status meals have various terms across Canada. Per diem, subsistence allowance, meal allowance or travel allowance, sometimes living allowance, but not technically. Let's use per diem. It's the Latin word for per day or for each day. The terminology isn't nearly as important as the system it's associated with, estimated reimbursement for a job-related cost. The system must be clear. It must verify travel status, inclusion, exclusions, method of pay, and rates. In the auditor's case, the per diem rate for a whole day as of October 1st, 2010 is $85.20. That's after tax funds. The Treasury Board of Canada, or National Joint Council, sets these rates. Some of the best features are rates are updated with raises every 6 months, April 1st and October 1st of each year. You can break down the rate meal by meal if you like, and no lobbying for increased rates, ever. $85.20 after tax compared to approximately $8 after tax. That's over 1,000% difference. Let's play with some historical numbers. In April 2007, when my book was published, the Treasury Board of Canada National Joint Council publication was $76.95. Compare that to 3 years later, April 1st, 2010, of $84.50 per day. That's an increase of $7.55 in just 3 years, compared to the lunch bag letdown increase of $5.29 over 5 years. With no lobbying. Using this system, Canadian citizens redefine taxable income into a non-taxable benefit. It is the most tax-efficient system available to Canadian truckers today. It appears dramatic primarily because the self-employed system grossly undercompensates job-related costs. Other than the annual net tax savings, which ranges from $6,000 to $9,000 plus, with additional Canada Pension Plan savings of about $1,950, the best benefit is no political shenanigans. If you want to get the government out of your business, stop playing their game. So, how do you qualify for this system? There are three conditions. Number one, employees only can collect a per diem. Number two, there must be an employer-employee agreement. And number three, the parameters of the agreement must be followed. It must have a clear audit trail, a separate check or transfer with paperwork reimbursing job-related costs. Therefore, no self-employed operator can ever qualify for this system because they will never be employees of themselves. Operators must reclassify themselves as employees. They can only do this by incorporating and become an employee of their own business. Let's talk about the disadvantages of using the per diem system, and there are seven of them. First is the cost of setup and maintaining your corporation. Opening a corporation can be costly, $700 to even $2,000 if you use a lawyer. Or you can set one up yourself on the internet from anywhere in Canada. Opening a corporation is intimidating for most people. There are so many confusing terms. Shareholders, directors, officers, president, minutes to meetings, annual returns, etc. Transferring a truck and assets into the company can be complicated, and I suggest most people use a professional. The work of an accountant is 2 to 2.5 times the work of a self-employed file. So, on average, expect higher accounting fees. Number two, the system is complex. It's designed to be complex. The Income Tax Act was written by accountants and lawyers in such a complex way that you become dependent on them. It's sad, but true. Taxpayers who have to pay a lot of taxes will hire a high-priced accountant or lawyer to save them taxes. This is how our tax system has always worked, generally. The old rich get richer rule. This system is no exception. Probably less than 2% of operators in Canada would be able to comply with the system without assistance. Then, even if they do everything right, they still may not be successful. I'll get back to that shortly. Here's an overview of its basic complexity. Once you incorporate, you have to open a brand new GST number. You have to transfer your assets through a bill of sale, lease transfer, or a Section 85 rollover. You have to have an employer-employee agreement, a clear separation of personal and business finances. You need to be paid a salary, which means you have to have monthly source deductions. You have to have a separate per diem and personal vehicle log checks with accompanying paperwork. Then consider all of these demands on a regular cash flow. For instance, the timing of a company pay versus the personal bills. It's a major issue. There is also a corporate timing cycle. Choosing your corporate year end. Why do we recommend a mid-year, for instance? Corporate taxes versus T4 income, source deductions on annual bonus, dividend versus taxable bonus, income splitting, annual corporate T2 return, T4s, T4 summaries, and how it all fits into your annual personal T1 income tax return. Navigate all the disadvantages of the system while considering your personal life complexities and situations. It is a complex system. The third disadvantage of using the system is source deduction taxes, your Canada pension and income tax. They're treated as money in trust rather than amount owing. Source deductions are different than income tax owing. Money in trust means Canada Revenue Agency has first access before everything else. Payments usually cannot be made for monies in trust. If you are making payments to CRA for your personal self-employed income tax, you may think you can't get out of the vicious cycle. You can. However, it takes 12 to 18 months. You do not have to double up on payments either, but you do have to use the per diem system. Following the rules of the per diem system will train you to get ahead of your taxes and never fall behind. The fourth disadvantage is bank financing issues. This is a biggie. Nationally, truck drivers make approximately $50,000 to $55,000 per year in annual taxable income and pay an average of $12,000 to $18,000 per year in income tax. using the per diem or subsistence allowance system, they would only report $25,000 to $30,000 in taxable income on their T4s. How do you think your loans officer would view this huge drop in income? Some loans officers understand what occurred. Others are just glorified tellers. For instance, some might place your truck loan payment under a personal T4 loan status, even if you are incorporated. This means a $2,500 a month truck payment consumes basically 100% of a $25,000 to $35,000 T4 income. How then have you been making your mortgage payment? Duh! Those who know the system also understand other industries who use it. Government officials such as RCMP, pilot and stewardesses, pipeline welders, etc. Our firm provides a special report showing both taxable income, T4, and non-taxable benefits. We're about 90% successful with that report. However, I personally don't think it's the success of our form as much as the combination of loans officer intelligence and lender's aggression. In other words, how much debt you already have and are you already going for. So, if you tend to borrow a great deal of money regularly, you may find yourself on the short end of the stick. Early on in life, it will be more important to have a high T4 or line 150 on your taxes. However, later on in life, you should have built up some equity, home, savings, assets, etc. So lenders should be less concerned with your line 150 and more impressed with equity or what you own outright. At least they should be. The fifth disadvantage of using the system is Canada Pension Plan. Canadian drivers declare $50,000 to $55,000 per year in taxable income and pay 12 to 18% in income tax. Some of that tax is Canada Pension, actually $4,326.30. Maximum CPP contribution is based on income of $47,200 in 2010. The average self-employed operator declares taxable income of more than $47,200 and therefore contributes the maximum CPP every year, but not under this system. Using the per diem, operators report only $25,000 to $30,000 taxable income on their T4s. For 2010, CPP estimated savings is $1,950.30. It will affect your CPP check when you retire. However, the question is, how much? CPP is not like employment insurance, where your check is based on your last couple of weeks. There is a long formula that is used to calculate how much you get. It considers the entire life's contribution total, the number of highest years versus the lowest years, etc. If you start using the system when you're 55 to 60 years old, there will be minimal change. If you start the system when you're 25 to 30, there will be a significant change. However, the cumulative annual $8,000 to $10,000 combined tax and CPP savings must be considered. $750 per month, or $9,000 per year for 30 years, is $270,000. Plus compound interest at only 5% is $625,000. CPP returns an average of 1 to 2.5% at best. The sixth disadvantage of using the system is disability issues, specifically workman's compensation, etc. What if you break your leg? What type of benefits will you receive if your taxable income is cut by 45 to 55%? Answer? Nothing survivable. We strongly recommend disability insurance or income replacement from an agent who understands the system. Usually WCB is calculated by percentage of gross for self-employed operators. Workman's compensation is calculated by line 150 of tax returns for T4s. Disability does not acknowledge per diem as income, rightfully so. Self-employed operators will receive a higher insurance check than will a per diem T4 operator. The seventh and final disadvantage is the liability of defending the system to CRA. The per diem system saves taxes compared to self-employed system. It's approximately $750 per month. Canada Revenue Agency got about $5,000 or $2,500 per year off the operators in Moncton, New Brunswick, from those who use the TL2 simplified method. If you use a per diem system and CRA rejects the filing, how much do you think CRA will reassess? It will be $10,000 per year plus penalties and interest. Can you afford a $25,000 reassessment? Does anyone think CRA just gives away potential tax revenue? Even if the operator complies completely, do you think CRA will accept it as filed all across the country without even trying the occasional rejection? When I wrote my book in 2007, I came to the conclusion CRA will try something somewhere. In my opinion, every operator who uses this system must be aware of this probability. If CRA will reassess, and I believe they will, who do you think they will go after? The taxpayer who has someone prepared to defend them? Or the isolated taxpayer, least prepared? If you use the system, will you be isolated? If you signed a waiver, you will be. Sometimes, even if you didn't sign a waiver, you can still be isolated. This is called potential liability and can add up to tens of thousands of dollars. I strongly recommend you don't use the system unless you have someone defend you. I've discussed potential liability several times in articles I've written. This is a serious issue. I've seen what some firms have done coast to coast, and in my opinion, way too many operators will not survive an audit. Here's an obvious example. One firm doesn't T4 the client. They are subcontractors of their own company. That means they are not classified as employees and cannot use the system. When I published my book in 2007, I realized that this was the most critical of all the issues. The savings are so huge, the scales tipped so unjustly, independent filing operators will always be vulnerable. If CRA can, they will. Given the complexity of this system, the necessity to educate clients one by one, and its level of liability, I concluded that an accounting firm needed to specialize in order to survive. If they don't, only a handful of operators will benefit. In order to successfully defend the system against reassessment, the client must have followed the rules of the system or provided an audit trail. Our firm, for instance, rates clients A, B, C, and D. New clients are all D-rated. Clients who fully comply are A-rated. One of the goals of our firm is to move clients from a D to an A. It usually takes between 2 and 6 months. A and B rated clients are fully defended by our firm. C and D rated clients are either given time to comply, given notice that they will not be defended, or are released to find another firm. There is no reason operators who refuse to comply should be given the opportunity to save taxes. So why haven't accountants used this system for operators in the past? Remember in the history of self-employed operators, we stated operators are a relatively new sector in the trucking industry. So why did accountants set up operators as self-employed initially? I'll list about 10 reasons. Becoming self-employed was, and is, easy. It's the easiest way to get into business. In the 80s, there was no GST. So by the time most accountants heard of the truck purchase, the operators had been self-employed for months. Simple, simple, simple. Don't change anything. The second reason is that the different systems had similar results. Gross inequality grew gradually. Over 30 years, the difference became 926% plus, but nobody bothered comparing along the way, or didn't think it was worth the effort. It was out of sight, out of mind. 30 years ago, the margins in the industry, including tax expenses, still provided operators a reasonable to strong income. Therefore, there was little demand for alternatives. The fourth reason, accountants are creatures of habit, and when they start doing something one way, it's difficult to change. operators were not exposed to any liability issues, which generally is the primary reason for incorporating. Trucking companies carried all the insurance directly. The sixth reason is corporations were expensive and costly to maintain. Both computer hardware costs and limited availability of software and the internet made the cost for alternatives too high. However, today the cost to start up is very low. Seventh reason is there was a different political environment. The per diem system was considered the system of the entitled. Alternative solutions were considered very risky and only for the elite taxpayers. Creative tax alternatives were left to the uber-rich or those who could afford the cost of a well-connected accountant tax lawyer. In other words, operators, not recognized as uber-rich, were truly isolated. They had little defense against the very powerful CRA. The eighth reason is the system is complex, and most truck drivers are not. The system has to be followed by employers and employees and defended by accountants. Accountants must train operators to comply to the system. This takes resources that accountants want to be paid for. Operators too often look for the cheapest accountant, not necessarily the best. Finally, as stated before, accountants need to defend the system to CRA, and because the system is complex, and most operators are not, the risk of non-compliance is abnormally high. Firms usually take this liability seriously, and if they're not serious about it, they just get you to sign a waiver. Then, like it or not, you have to be serious about it. Why accountants don't do it today? I write articles regularly for industry magazines. I talk with many operators and accountants coast to coast. Most tax preparers are not aware of the system until I explain it to them. Also, many tax preparers for operators are not trained to report this system. They typically only know about how to file self-employed income tax returns and are intimidated by per diem's complexity. Many accountants may understand the system, but still will not use it because they don't have time to train you, they don't have time to train their staff, they don't have resources to defend the system to CRA. They may individually do it for you, but as stated several times, will probably require a waiver. The accounting industry has the highest level of sentiment in any industry. People can stand naked in front of a doctor and feel less exposed and vulnerable than when they're talking to their accountant about how they spend money. It develops a great deal of loyalty in most people. Yet, if they even do know about it, too many accountants don't wish to expose themselves to the complexity. They manage their firm too conservatively, sometimes at the expense of their clients. Liability is this system's most critical issue. You should keep asking until you understand your personal risks clearly. If you are not incorporated or incorporated and not paying yourself a monthly per diem, you are simply paying too much taxes. Saving taxes has nothing to do with how smart, good, or nice your accountant is. They are all restricted by the rules within the system they decide to use. Not everybody decides to use the system. If you've been an operator for many years, you know the fluctuation of income year over year. Comparing the bottom line tax bill of a self-employed bad year to a per diem good year may actually be the same. Comparing a high depreciation self-employed year to a first year 50% depreciation per diem poor year may also be similar. Some people have quit the system because they simply don't see it. Some operators, very few, have started the system but changed their mind after only a short time. They stop because they don't understand. They became confused or spoke to somebody who scared them yet didn't really know what they were talking about. I had an operator stand up and leave as soon as they heard the disadvantages of borrowing money. They had a wish list of things they wanted to buy and would rather pay higher taxes than be forced to sacrifice their toys. Some taxpayers' expectations are not realistic. They are searching for a magic pill that will totally eliminate taxes. If your earnings are in the top 50% of operators, the per diem system will not eliminate your taxes. It will legally reduce it compared to self-employed, but it will not eliminate it. Some operators are still looking for that magic pill. Since my book was published in 2007, I've talked to operators and accountants all across Canada and, unfortunately, witnessed many instances of tax return fraud. I've seen tax preparers attract clients by flat-out lying on returns. I've seen an $11,000 tax bill reduced to a $500 refund using the exact same documents. On the West Coast, one firm just simply added $20,000 to $30,000 to fuel expenses. Recently, on the East Coast, one accountant was incarcerated for fraud on behalf of his or her clients. Some shifty and crooked bookkeepers lie on behalf of their clients so they can grow their business. They disrespect the laws of our country, and ultimately, they will disrespect you. Let's get this straight. Just because someone lies for you doesn't mean you aren't lying. In the end, you are still responsible, penalties and interest included. Studies have shown Canadians don't mind paying their fair share of taxes as long as they are convinced it's their fair share. As my book exposed, the per diem system is the most just and equality-based system available to Canadian operators. There is no need to lie or have someone lie for you. Silvio Berlusconi is the Prime Minister of Italy. Believe it or not, he was quoted as saying, "If taxes are too high, it is morally acceptable to evade them." Think about that for a moment. It's no wonder that 25% of Italy's economy is the black market. Canada does not have to go that route. We have the ability to pay only our fair share of taxes. We can sleep soundly. Now a little bit of advice to those who wish to start. Learn the system step by step. Don't try and absorb it completely. It is complex. On the cover of this CD is a client number. It refers to a specific A-rated client within our system. They know what it means to comply. It is most likely who you got the CD from. They know the complexity of how to qualify as an A-rated client. They also live with the system's disadvantages. Take the necessary time to learn and do your part. Delegate what you don't understand yet. Your relationship with your accountant will change dramatically. Your communication with them may start out weekly, but will eventually settle down to monthly, rarely quarterly or annually. Saving $600 to $800 plus per month, over $8,000 per year, should take time and effort. Nothing good comes for free. Remember, you are not dealing with $100 or even thousands, but tens of thousands of dollars. Either do it right or don't do it at all. Doing it wrong means you will most likely be wiped out. This CD was more difficult to do than writing my first book or my second. I have performed this seminar over 200 times. Not once was it the same. There's just far too much information and availability of rabbit trails. I once did 3 seminars in one day. The final seminar had me rambling like an idiot. The couple I presented it to must have thought I was insane. I never seen them again. If you're listening, I'm sorry. Well, maybe I should apologize to you. Maybe you also thought I was rambling. This is a lot of information. You probably have more questions than you had before the seminar. This is normal. After several years of doing this seminar, I've accumulated the basic questions most everyone asks. This question and answer and interview portion of the seminar will be much more informal. First question, what is an incorporation? Let's talk to a lawyer. Well, okay, here we are. We're going to be talking to a lawyer. We'll ask some questions that pretty much everybody has with regards to incorporation, a whole bunch of questions. What's your name?
My name's Herb.
Herb. Here we go. First of all, I'd like you to describe a little bit about a corporation and what does it actually mean?
Well, a corporation is its own person. It can own things. It can sell things. It can enter into contracts. It can enter into lawsuits. Basically anything that a human being could do.
So it's a little bit like having a baby or a child or something.
Yeah, to a certain extent, it exists separately and apart from you.
Okay. So there's a considerable difference then between, say, a registered business name and a corporation then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. A registered business is simply a label that a business uses in the marketplace. It doesn't necessarily mean the business is incorporated. It could be a simple proprietorship owned by a private person.
Okay. What is the process of choosing a name for a corporation?
Well, you have to have the name cleared by the company's office in your jurisdiction. And if the name is similar to another company that already exists, you won't get clearance to use that name because it might confuse the public.
Can you choose, I know there's, say, for instance, an actual name, like IBM Corporation or something like that, or there's also numbered companies, right?
Sure. You could make up a name, and as long as it's not offensive, that'll be fine. Some people really put no value in the name of their company, and then they're just assigned a random number by the company's office.
Okay. Can you change your name?
Yeah, a company can change its name. And there might be certain confusion that causes to your customers or to Revenue Canada. But otherwise, there's nothing stopping you from changing your name if that's what you want to do.
Okay. What is the difference between, say, incorporation, LTD, limited, company, that kind of thing?
It almost always amounts to the same thing. Americans tend to use the name company. Canadians traditionally have used the name corporation. And Americans tend not to know how we do things in Canada often, and they don't often understand what limited means. They're more familiar with Inc. or incorporated. But it describes the same thing. It's a separate legal entity that has limited liability.
So it doesn't make any difference whether you put LTD, limited, Inc., incorporation behind your name?
No. Legally, it makes no difference.
What are articles of incorporation?
That's the birth certificate for a company. And it gives, as of the date that that's recorded in the company's office in your jurisdiction, the company then has legal status, and it can do all the things that any company can do.
Okay. Who fills out the articles?
It's the signature of the first director. The director is the guiding mind that signs the articles of incorporation, and then from there a company is organized, the shareholders are set, and the officers are set.
What are bylaws?
Bylaws are the rules and regulations under which the company operates. For example, when are meetings held? How are you given notice of a meeting? Who can show up at a meeting? How are the votes held? Those types of things.
Okay. In the bylaws, does it also state whether a corporation can open a bank account, or is that different?
The bylaws would establish that the company can open bank accounts and can apply for lines of credit or other kinds of loans.
Okay. So that's included in the bylaws. Are there any corporations that have no bylaws?
I've never created one.
There's no rules. Yeah, you can't do anything, I guess.
Well, exactly. Then it raises all kinds of complicated questions if you don't have bylaws. Well, for example, who appointed you to do this task? Was it approved? And if so, how? How was it approved? There's rules on the road. There've got to be rules inside a corporation.
Sure. Okay. What is a holding company?
A holding company is typically used by lawyers to describe a company that doesn't operate a business on an active basis. It typically owns pieces of paper or investments, but it doesn't operate a business on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. There's a few times in the last several years that I've had some individuals who had their own corporation, but their prior either accountant or their lawyer has said that they should have a holding company. Now, if it doesn't actually operate a business, the average type of people we're talking to is individuals who own their own truck, drive their own truck. Pretty much that is their sole source of income. What would the advantages of having a holding company be?
Well, if you're in that happy situation where you have lots of extra money sitting in your corporation and retained earnings, it's probably time to start thinking about a holding company and pushing money out of the operating company into a holding company. But that's really only going to happen when the company is well established and has a substantial stream of income.
Ah, okay. So we can stroke that one off of our list for owner-operators. Okay. What is a corporate seal and why do you need one?
A corporate seal is basically a metal clamp that embosses paper, and It's usually circular, and it embosses the paper with little ridges and bumps. If a company has a seal, it can sign certain legal documents without any witnesses.
Hmm. Is it popular or is it not popular?
Well, back in the day, they didn't cost very much. But as the costs of seals have increased, the demand by corporations has decreased because they would just rather have a witness the signature of the director or of the officer of the company.
So if you're going to a bank to make a loan for, say, a truck or something like that, all you really have is, say, one individual who's a shareholder and they have to have a witness?
The banker would witness the signature on the loan document just to prove that that was a valid signature by a company officer.
Is it a fad that's coming in or going out?
I think you're going to see less and less corporate seals as the years go on.
Oh, yeah. Okay. What are shares of a corporation?
When a corporation is profitable, and let's hope that it is, the people that receive the profits are the shareholders. So if you have a certain percentage of the company's shares, that entitles you to a certain percentage of the company's profits.
Okay, so
or dividends.
You're the owner of the corporation.
The owner or one of the owners, yes.
Okay. Just because Canadian truck drivers are educated through Hollywood, what is the difference between a public and a private corporation?
Well, a public corporation is registered on the stock exchange.
Okay.
Very few of your owner-operators are registered on the stock exchange. They're private companies. They're held by private individuals, and the profits are limited to a very small group of people, not to the general public.
I see. Okay. So in order to get something to go from a private to a public, there's a whole bunch of hoops that a person has to jump in order just to get their name on the stock exchange. And owning one truck or actually owning 100 trucks may never even get you in there.
No, the securities regulators would have a ton of questions for you if you wanted to go public.
Yeah. How long does it take to get a corporation active?
Well, in many jurisdictions, you can get overnight service, or in some, you can register even online. So it shouldn't take more than a day or two.
Would they provide any bylaws?
No, they wouldn't. They would just give you the bare bones articles of incorporation, and that would just demonstrate to the public that the company is active, but who's behind the company and so on, that wouldn't necessarily be shown.
Don't the bylaws actually have to be submitted or not?
If you're imposing restrictions on the nature of the business the company can do or the shareholders and so on, yes, that has to be then attached.
Okay.
If you're imposing restrictions from the get-go. So, but typically, the schedules that are attached to the Articles of Incorporation wouldn't describe how votes are held or who can vote and so on.
Okay.
Those are very detailed and they often go on for dozens of pages.
Okay. What does it actually mean to be a shareholder?
Well, the shareholders are entitled to receive the profits of the company in simple terms. And as such, they have rights to vote directors in or out, and they have a say in how the company operates to a certain extent.
How easy is it to buy and sell shares?
Typically, in a small corporation, a private corporation, there would be strict rules on how you can come in or get out as a shareholder.
Okay. And that refers back maybe to the bylaws, I guess.
Exactly. And the bylaws would spell out a very specific process as to how that can happen, because you don't want a shareholder in a small business to simply bring in someone off the street to take over as a shareholder and be involved in the company and have a say in how the company operates.
Okay. What does it mean to be a director? I guess the other thing that a shareholder actually does is elect directors, correct?
Correct.
So other than collecting the income, that's their only real role, I guess it would be, is electing a director. What does it mean to be a director?
Well, as a director, you're accepting a certain amount of responsibility to ensure that the company is operated properly. Or be prepared to take responsibility for certain things. For example, that any government remittances, CPP on employees or employment insurance on employee wages, are properly submitted. Any taxes that are collected, like GST, that it's properly submitted. Because if the company doesn't do it properly, you personally, as a director, will be responsible for the payment.
They would be personally liable for the government forms, I guess you'd be, but they would not necessarily be personally liable for a regular bill that came through for, you know, fuel or tires or anything like that, would it?
Correct. A director wouldn't be responsible for a contractual relationship with a supplier or a customer. but you are responsible to government.
Yeah, okay. Are they appointed indefinitely? What is it? What's the restriction on that?
In most jurisdictions, there's a requirement in the Companies Act to have an annual meeting of shareholders.
Okay.
And at that meeting, the directors would always be either reappointed or new ones would be elected.
So it's not like a term, like a 2 or 3 year term or
no.
anything like that?
No, it would come up every year.
Okay. How easy is it for one to step down?
Yeah, you have to formally register your resignation with the company's office in your jurisdiction for it to have effect. And you can't escape any liability that occurred on your watch.
Oh, I see.
So if a government remittance was due on the first of the month and you resigned on the second of the month, you're liable for that remittance even if you've resigned on the second of the month.
I see. Are directors employees?
They don't have to be, but they can.
But that would be like a separate role for them then? Or is it a paid position? I remember some Hollywood movies where directors were getting something, whether it was a free meal or X amount of dollars per meeting or something like that. Or
well, directors are taking a risk. And sometimes in a larger corporation, they want to be compensated for taking the risk.
Mm.
So if assuming that the company has the cash flow, it would pay its directors. But otherwise, in your typical owner-operator situation, there's no cash to pay a director's fee.
But it can be done.
Certainly it can be done, yeah.
Okay, what is an officer?
Officers are appointed to make sure that the day-to-day legal requirements of the company are met. Typically, it's the president, it's the secretary, and the treasurer. And they make sure that the meetings are properly conducted and that there's someone recording what's said at the meetings and how the votes go, and that that's properly reported then to the lawyer and to the accountant who are doing the professional work for the corporation.
Hmm. What's the difference between a president and a vice president?
Well, the bylaws would typically define what the duties and responsibilities are, but typically there wouldn't be any significant difference.
Okay. So let's say I was a director, I appointed myself as the president. I would be the one who would decide what truck to buy, what trucking company to put it on. Does the director do the banking stuff or?
Typically, the director doesn't get involved in the day-to-day operations.
Okay.
Think of the director more like the brain and think of the officers more like the hands. Hmm. Of the company. And if a company, as it grows, very often it hires employees to be managers and take on other key functions, whether it's human resources or what have you.
Okay. But in a very small corporation, one, two shareholders, you know, one driver maybe, which is the typical,
right.
the audience that we're dealing with, person can obviously hold several hats at the same time.
Absolutely. It's not uncommon to have one single person. And that same person is the director of the corporation, the president and the secretary of the corporation.
And the shareholder.
And the sole shareholder and the employee of the corporation.
Yeah. So there's lots of different roles. Okay, in this seminar that we're presenting to operators across Canada, we're talking about the per diem system, and one of the qualifications is having an employer-employee agreement. And primarily the agreement would be between one of the officers, say the president of the corporation, and the driver, which more often than not can often be the same person. Can that actually happen? Can you actually make an agreement and you sign on both sides of the piece of paper?
A lot of people have a mental block about this, but yeah, absolutely. Bear in mind what we said at the beginning of our conversation, that a corporation is a separate legal entity. It exists separate and apart from who the actual shareholders are.
So a person would sign on behalf of the corporation, as they say, president,
mm-hmm.
and then turn around, flip paper or whatever, and sign as their own for themselves.
Right, because an employment contract is exactly what you suggest. It's an agreement between two separate parties. One party that agrees to give employment and the other party agrees to accept employment under certain terms and conditions. And if the two parties have agreed, they've made a contract.
Okay. What is a corporation's minute book?
The minute book is really a log in which you record all of the history of all the meetings and what's said at the meetings and how the votes are held. It would also record who the shareholders are and would also hold the share certificates themselves.
Okay. Do you have to have a minute book by law, I guess, or?
There's no legal requirement that says you have to collect all of this data in one central location. But in practical terms, it's convenient to have it all in one location.
I see. Okay, so it's a little bit like a diary or a roadmap of where you've gone. Logbook, I guess, would be what most truckers understand it.
I think that's the best analogy I can think of.
Sure. Who holds the minute book generally?
In general terms, it's the lawyer who holds the minute book because the lawyer has to keep it updated on an annual basis. And your lawyer typically would be contacting you as the shareholder or the director saying, hey, it's time for the annual meeting. What were the results of the meeting? Can the secretary of the corporation pass on the minutes to me so that I can enter them into the minute book?
Okay. What happens, for instance, if a minute book, and I've heard of this happening before, you know, gets destroyed by fire or something like that? Where's the problems in that?
Well, obviously, you want an accurate record as possible of what has happened in the past. But if that's lost, the directors at the time and the shareholders would have to have a special meeting and pass resolutions confirming that everything that the corporation's done in the previous years was properly done and that no one feels that they've been hard done by anything that's happened in the past. You want to know that everyone who's currently in the corporation, in whatever capacity, is happy with what has happened in the past, and they don't have a grievance that's going to pop up in the future that hasn't been recorded.
Okay. So that's the legal aspect of it. But I guess from an accounting perspective, there can be, I guess you'd call it a liability or an issue with regards to, say, Canada Revenue Agency. They can come in and say, okay, well, say possibly everything that's happened prior to this date we have issue with, and now you're on the defensive trying to reconstruct stuff?
Yeah, it's certainly very difficult to reconstruct the past. I suspect that the shareholders would be required to give sworn statements.
Oh, yeah.
To record that this is how we agreed to things in the past, and even though that the minutes are now being created after the fact or well after the fact, they still accurately reflect what truly happened.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been in the industry for over 20 years, and I think in that time, maybe I've had Canada Revenue Agency ask for the minute book two, maybe three times, and that was more of a, I guess, maybe a routine questioning than anything, but it doesn't happen very often. The only time when they become really aggressive, I guess you would say it, is when they sense or feel that there was something fraudulent or someone was trying to cover something up or there was something like that. So there's a fair bit of grace there, but I mean, from a legal perspective, I mean, the minute book is a sensitive document, I guess.
Absolutely. And it gives a lot of comfort to the auditor from Canada Revenue Agency if all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed.
Okay. Okay. So let's go another question here. What are annual returns? Or annual meetings, I guess, and annual returns and meetings, I guess.
Well, I think I mentioned before that every company has to have an annual meeting of shareholders, an annual general meeting, if you will. And that's recorded then in the minute book. Apart from that, the company's office in your jurisdiction will require you to file an annual statement which shows who the directors are for that year and what their mailing addresses are and who the primary shareholders are and who are the signing officers, the president and the secretary and the treasurer and so on.
Okay. Now, do you need a lawyer present at the meeting or do you just, I guess, submit it to a lawyer
for
them?
There's no legal requirement for a lawyer to be present at the meeting.
Okay. Here's a question I get asked all the time. Can you fly to Mexico to have an annual meeting? Puerto Vallarta, specifically.
I've never specifically recorded the country in which the meeting has been recorded, but there's nothing to say that if all of the shareholders agree that the meeting couldn't be held in a foreign jurisdiction.
Okay. Now, I guess Hollywood has always portrayed board meetings to be in exotic locations, Barbados, or maybe that's just because some of the story or plot lines or something like that. But by law, they have to have a meeting, and by law, they can have it anywhere they want, I guess.
Yeah, and there's nothing stopping the meeting from being held in your living room on a Saturday night and everyone convening afterwards to watch Hockey Night in Canada.
Oh, there you go. Okay, do all corporations need an auditor?
No. The shareholders can have a vote at the annual meeting and decide that they're going to waive the involvement of an auditor. However, any one shareholder can insist on one if that's what they want to do.
Okay. In a very small corporation, one, two, typically a husband, wife, or a small corporation like that, there is no legal requirement for them to have a lawyer or an auditor, I mean?
No, and assuming the husband and wife got along, neither one of them would demand an auditor.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. If we're not getting along, all bets are off.
There we go. I've heard, I've read somewhere in some of the minute books, dispense with the appointment of an auditor. That's why I brought up the question, because I didn't know whether they had to dispense with it every year or...
They do, yes.
Yeah, they do. I see. Okay. Okay. Do all corporations need a lawyer? I ask a lawyer.
Conflict of interest. No, there's no requirement for you to have a lawyer if you're representing yourself in court, for example. Okay. And there's no requirement that says you have to have a lawyer prepare your articles of incorporation or your will or your divorce for that matter.
Okay. Why should they need one?
Well, think of it this way. I could probably go to a hardware store and buy a toilet and install it in my house, but I'd much rather pay a plumber to come and do the job and know that it's been done correctly. Hmm. And if there is a problem later on, that I can call that plumber and have him come back and fix the problem. So why wouldn't you want a professional to do the job and do it right?
Okay. What situation provides the least amount of risk in not having a lawyer?
Well, if you have one person wearing all of the hats as officer, director, shareholder, and employee, there's very little risk of a conflict happening with other parties. And that would be the answer to the question.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. What is the situation that would require the most amount of risk?
Well, the more parties that are involved in the corporation, the greater the chance of a disagreement occurring or a misunderstanding occurring. And that's why it would be crucial to have the documents prepared correctly.
Now we're going to tread on some thin ice here. And it's been asked me all the time, and I want to get a legal opinion on this. When it comes to, say, a husband and wife, both owning shares of the corporation, directors and the like, what percentage should the husband have and what percentage should the wife have?
I guess it depends on which side of the debate you're on.
Are you a friend of the bride or are you a friend of the groom?
If it's an equal 50-50 shareholding situation, you're going to be in gridlock because the shareholders are never going to agree on appointing a new director, for example, or how to deal with the bank or how to report things to the accountant or the lawyer, as the case may be.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a terribly unfortunate situation when that happens, because if the company has some assets, you want to make sure that they're handled correctly or that they're sold at the highest possible price to benefit the shareholders in the best possible way.
I had a friend who owned 49% of a corporation that made a great deal of money. And in the end, it was managed in such a way, well, he had no control of 49%. From there, we basically said, if you own 49% of something, you might as well own nothing, unless you want to sue somebody till the cows come home. But if I would own 51% of a corporation, then practically speaking, I could have a meeting, take whoever I want out as a director, take anybody out as an officer, and I have absolute and total control then.
Subject to your obligations to not act in prejudice to the other shareholder.
Yes, yeah. Yes,
like you can't undermine someone else's investment
or
financial position in the company. But yes, the ability to conduct meetings, to appoint assigning officers at the bank, you would have control of that process.
Oh, I see. Okay. What is the difference between a federal and provincial corporation?
If the corporate name is very important to you and the corporate identity or any of the logos or trademarks are important to you, then you should be registered federally, because then your name is protected in every province in Canada.
Okay. Is there any cost difference between federal and provincial corporations?
The costs are not dramatically different.
Now we're into the lightning round, your commonly asked questions. Can I change my current business bank account to my new corporate name?
No. Remember, the company is a separate legal entity. It has to open a brand new bank account.
Okay, now I'm going to twist it here. I've been doing this for a number of years. I've seen it done three times. The first time it happened, I almost had a heart attack. I thought, what in the world is this? And I'm not going to say what chartered bank it was that did it, but they actually did it. And they just changed the name from whatever it was, the individual's name. But I've seen it done at a chartered bank and a credit union.
Wow.
But that primarily would have to be something that a loans officer would do, I guess, eh?
Yes, and typically when, just because of the disclosure rules now and anti-terrorism rules are just so tight, you have to provide certified copies of articles of incorporation, for example, to open a corporate bank account, because no financial institution wants to be opening dummy bank accounts for phony corporations, right?
Sure, yeah.
So there's a lot more due diligence that happens.
Just as a question, who would be held liable then? Would it be held the bank or the director or shareholders?
I guess it depends on who is harmed. But if the bank hasn't followed its own protocols, the bank would be liable, I would suspect.
Wow. Okay, can I have my kids as shareholders or directors or officers? Why or why not?
Well, the answer is yes. You can have your kids involved in the corporation. But practically speaking, if they're under the age of 18, then any dividends that are paid to them are taxed at 50%. So there's no real advantage to paying dividends to a child that's under the age of 18.
But they can participate at meetings, have their votes counted in that too? Or?
Well, if the child is under 18, they can't enter into legally binding contracts.
Oh.
But again, there's nothing wrong with making a child a shareholder, but not that just delaying the payment of dividends until the child turns 18 years of age.
Oh.
If the child is an employee of the corporation underage, it can be paid a wage for work that the child is doing for the corporation. That's okay. Certainly acceptable.
Okay. What about shareholder agreements? What are they and how does it affect the whole chain of responsibilities?
Well, if you have multiple shareholders in a corporation, you want to establish at the beginning of the relationship how you get in and how you get out. For example, what happens when a shareholder dies? How is the estate of that shareholder compensated for the value of those shares? What if the company or the corporation doesn't have enough cash in the bank account to pay out the value? What happens? So it's important to set out in advance what the procedures will be that are going to be followed so that everyone knows before the game starts how big the field is, how wide is the field, where are the goalposts, and so on.
So in a situation like that, like when one of the shareholders dies or whatever, it could almost destroy the entire company because legally it has to dissolve at half the assets and probably have to sell all the assets.
Well, exactly, because the estate of the shareholder could demand value, the fair market value of those shares. The equity of the company is tied up in other assets.
Like a truck.
Yeah. It would suddenly have to sell the truck to pay out the shareholder, and that would be a very unhappy situation.
Is that why some corporations own life insurance policies on their shareholders?
Exactly, so that there's a pool of cash to pay out the share value.
Okay. In case of a bankruptcy, let's say the truck is not making any money, things are getting tighter and tighter and can't make the payments and everything is going south. If the corporation declares bankruptcy, that would absolve itself of any liability on there, right?
Well, the key thing to remember is that as a shareholder in that company that's declared bankruptcy, your worst case scenario is that your shares lose all their value.
Yeah.
But they go to zero. You can't go below zero as a shareholder in a company.
Okay. The vast majority of times when a small corporation borrows money, let's say they borrow it from a financial institution of some sort to buy a highway tractor, it is the director who personally signs for the asset in question, right?
Yeah. Typically a bank or a financial institution will want personal guarantees from the people behind the corporation because the company doesn't have enough of a track record financially to justify a loan. But again, that would be an obligation only to that financial institution. It wouldn't be an obligation to anyone else in the general public.
Okay. So it is a frequently asked question that, if things go south, then I can just declare bankruptcy and walk away. But the bottom line is, as director of a corporation, you sign for it personally. You're personally liable for the payment of that truck if anything ever does go south.
And likely, the first question your lawyer will be asking if you say the company's gone bankrupt, the first question will be, have you personally signed for any of the corporation's obligations?
Yes. Okay, how easy is it to actually close a corporation?
Well, you can do literally nothing for 2 years, and the company's office will strike the corporation from the record.
Oh, so it doesn't cost anything. Exactly. You just have to wait it out for nothing on there. Right around the 1 year mark, you'd have Revenue Canada screaming at you for GST return source deductions on annual returns and everything.
Those questions don't disappear.
They don't disappear. So from the company's office, everybody would be happy, but from Revenue Canada, you got a whole bunch of questions yet to answer. So in other words, well, I guess the accounting answer to that is the corporate T2s still have to be filed, as well as the GST returns and source deductions.
Absolutely.
T4s, everything has to be done. So if a person wanted to do it, I guess, I shouldn't say legally, but formally, I guess you just, you fill out some forms?
It's called Articles of Dissolution. Remember, we've had Articles of Incorporation that gave birth to the company?
Okay.
Well, the Articles of Dissolution are the death certificate.
There we go. Okay, and one final question here, commonly asked question. How long does the mint book actually have to be kept?
For as long as the company is active.
Does it have to keep it after that? Like, I know from an income tax perspective, people have to hold their records for, I think, 7 years or so. I know they rarely ever get audited anything further back than four. But from a corporation, the company's office really doesn't care. Once it's dissolved, then they don't care anymore.
Correct.
It's just Revenue Canada that has to be.
Or any other creditor that believes that they're owed money by the company, or employee who's believes they're entitled to wages, for example.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming out today.
It's been a pleasure.
Hopefully this has helped truck drivers all across Canada. So in summary, incorporate your business, become an employee of your own corporation, negotiate an employer-employee agreement, and then follow the rules. Now the next question. What time of year is best to incorporate and start the per diem system? The answer? Now. Every month that goes by is a month you can't collect per diem. What time of year you start is immaterial. If something goes wrong, can the corporation hold all the debts or liabilities? Almost always, no. Financial institutions require personal guarantees on all purchases or leases. They will not care whether you're incorporated or not, as long as you've signed your personal guarantee. Remember, if liability was the only reason to incorporate, I would recommend no operator incorporate. In the operations of a truck, liability is covered by the trucking company, and financial institutions require personal guarantees. Now the next question. Can you backdate per diem to reduce prior year's returns? No. Per diem can only be collected once an employer-employee agreement is in place. Therefore, the quickest it can be applied is on or shortly after the date of incorporation. This is the bottleneck in the entire system. National averages show that for every month that goes by, you are liable for another $750 in taxes. You can see that the break-even point is about 2 months for a client. Actually, 6+ months for an accountant, since there is a lot of work to set up. Should the corporation own a vehicle so it can write everything off? Answer? No. If it does, you must still complete a log on the corporate vehicle, same as the self-employed log. It is also extremely inefficient because there is a nasty thing called standby charges. If that vehicle was parked just one night on your personal driveway, you qualify for being assessed standby charges. The logic is, if someone broke a leg, you could use the vehicle personally, even if you never did. The calculations are approximately one-third of the cost of the vehicle is assigned as a taxable benefit, as opposed to non-taxable benefit, with no depreciating value. Therefore, a $30,000 vehicle can have a $10,000 taxable benefit assigned to your T4 every year, for as long as the corporation owns it if the vehicle is parked in your driveway once each year. I was told it was written to discourage car salesmen from driving home new demo cars. It's very expensive. Please insert next CD.